big news of 59. CBS Radio now presents the big news of 59. The events that made history during the year. The sounds and words that made big news in 59. Reported and placed in perspective by the staff of experienced CBS correspondents who covered these events as they happened, where they happened. Now, here is your narrator, Walter Cronkite.
...1959 was a year of movement and a year of firsts. President Eisenhower made two trips abroad. Nikita Khrushchev of Russia came to this country, the first time a Russian premier had visited the United States. Great strides were made in the conquest of space, with Russia hitting the moon, and the Soviets also photographed for the first time the moon's hidden side. Although the year began with the temperature of the Cold War close to freezing, it appeared at year's end that some of the ice was beginning to melt. One of the principal signs that a warm wind was blowing across the sea of international affairs was the Cross America tour made this fall by Khrushchev and his family. It was an illuminating, if at times boisterous, experience for Russians and Americans alike. And Daniel Shore was brought home from his post in Eastern Europe to cover that story.
It was a great day, and the day he had long awaited, when Soviet Premier Khrushchev arrived at Andrews Air Force Base near Washington on September 15th. His objectives were two: to sell himself and his country to the American people, and to start the process of selling his brand of coexistence to President Eisenhower and our government. Standing next to the president, his bald head bare to the bright sun, Khrushchev started his mission with these words.
We have come here with an open heart and good intentions. The Soviet people want to live in friendship with the American people. There are no obstacles to having relations between our countries developed as good neighborly relations.
Next day, after his opening round of talks and social events at the White House, Khrushchev spelled out his objectives in a little more detail before the National Press Club.
Меня спрашивают, каких результатов можно ожидать от нашего визита. Мы только что вчера прибыли в столицу Соединенных Штатов. Было бы преждевременным...
I have been asked what results may be expected from our visit. We would like to reach agreement with your government on issues of vital importance. These issues are numerous, but first of all, I should like to mention the easement of international tensions and abolition of the Cold War, disarmament, a peace treaty with Germany, world trade, and improvement of the relations between our two countries.
His flag planted in Washington, and the more important talks with the president scheduled for the end of his 13-day stay, Khrushchev started on his coast-to-coast swing around America, which rapidly began to develop a sense of tension. First, New York, where the Soviet premier heard Mayor Robert Wagner and others at a civic luncheon defend the capitalist system. Khrushchev departed from his set speech to reply.
If you like capitalism, and I'm sure that you do, God's with you. Continue in your efforts, but take care. A new system has emerged, a system that is treading, that has started to tread on your heels. And if at any time you start lagging behind, we will certainly surpass you.
Next, Hyde Park and a visit to the Roosevelt home, and back to New York to make a far-reaching, if vague, proposal to the United Nations Assembly.
The essence of our proposals is that over a period of 4 years, all states should effect complete disarmament and should no longer have any means of waging war. At the disposal of states, there should remain only strictly limited contingents of police or militia agreed upon for each country, armed with small arms and intended exclusively to maintain internal order and protect the personal security of the citizens.
Next, a transcontinental jet flight to Los Angeles, where Khrushchev began to display mounting temper. He scowled as Mayor Norris Paulson's curt greeting at the airport, and by lunchtime, when he met the Hollywood great, he was ready to blow off steam. He tilted verbally with Spira Skouras of 20th Century Fox about whether America or Russia provides better opportunities for poor people to get ahead. He exploded about the way his trip had been organized.
When I came here to the city, I was given a plan, a program of what I was to be shown and whom I was to meet here.
А сейчас мне подошли и сказали: нет, вы, говорит, в такой-то городок поехать не можете. Как называется он?
Да. But just now I was told that I couldn't go to Disneyland.
Я говорю, почему?
I asked, why not?
Может быть, там теперь ракетные площадки созданы?
What is it you have?
По запуску ракет?
Rocket launching pads there?
Я не знаю, да.
I don't know.
Да. Мне говорят, видите, ехать вам нельзя туда потому, что мы, вот послушайте, послушайте, что, говорит, мы, то есть американские власти не могут, если я туда поеду, гарантировать мою безопасность.
And just listen to what I was told, to what reason I was told. We, which means the American authority, cannot guarantee your security if you go there.
Что у вас там, холера, что ли, развелась, понимаете, или что там, понимаете, чума, что ли, что я могу заразиться?
What is it? Is there an epidemic of cholera there or something?
Я говорю, я очень хотел бы посмотреть. Я говорю, что я очень хотел бы поехать и посмотреть.
And I say, I would very much like to go and see Disneyland.
Мы тогда...
He seemed to enjoy a rehearsal of the movie Can-Can introduced by Frank Sinatra.
Most chances we never synchronize very good, but you'll have to forgive us because we didn't rehearse, so we've been out late. Right? Okay. Now, this number, appropriately enough, is called Live and Let Live. And it's a marvelous idea. Gentlemen.
Live and let live.
Do and let do.
Do and let do.
Hear and let hear.
All right, but sue and let sue.
What for?
Dream and let dream.
If you can hold it.
But after hearing Louis Jourdain and Maurice Chevalier and gaping at the can-can dancers, Khrushchev later decided that the show was pornographic. The climax came at a dinner that night.
The unpleasant thought sometimes creeps up on me here as to whether perhaps Khrushchev was not invited here to enable you to sort of rub him in your sauce and to show the might and the strength of the United States so as to make him sort of, so as to make him shaky at the knees. If that is so, then if it took me about 12 hours to get here, I guess it'll take no more than about 10 and a half hours to fly back.
Khrushchev's threat was an effective maneuver, putting his hosts on the defensive. Next day he was, as he put it, released from house arrest. Mixing gregariously with crowds at wayside stations on the rail trip to San Francisco. In San Francisco, he had a fine time, marred only by a stormy session with labor leaders. Heading back eastward again, Khrushchev toured the farm of his friend Roswell Goss at Coon Rapids, Iowa, amid a milling crowd of reporters that stirred his host to anger. He mugged, he waved an ear of corn, he boasted of Russian successes. He flew on to Pittsburgh and then back to Washington for the ceremonial windup and for the real business, the 2 days of talks with President Eisenhower at Camp David. Talks that Khrushchev summed up at his final news conference in Washington this way.
We had pleasant talks with him, and on all the subjects touched upon, there was a great deal in common in our understanding of the position and about and in our understanding of the need to improve relations between our two countries. I have no doubt whatsoever that the president is sincere in his desire to improve relations between our countries.
Khrushchev seemed happy. He had wowed America, made his pitch to President Eisenhower, he felt he had opened a new era in Soviet-American relations. In a farewell broadcast, he put it this way.
Permit me, in conclusion, to wish the American people prosperity and happiness, and to express the hope that our visit to the United States and the forthcoming trip of President Eisenhower to the Soviet Union will be regarded not only by the American and Soviet people, but everywhere in the world as the beginning of joint efforts in the quest for ways of beginning, of bringing our nations closer together and strengthening general peace.
Goodbye. Good luck, friends.
Khrushchev in America. A visit that America will not soon forget.
While the drama and fascination of Khrushchev's visit to the United States will be long remembered, in 1959, the American chief executive broke all precedents and journeyed to the faraway countries of Asia, where the spectacle of his visit made a deep impression on the millions who flocked to see him. It was the second overseas trip for Mr. Eisenhower this year, the first to Europe for talks with our allies. But it was the 11-nation odyssey, including visits to five Asian countries, which captured the imagination of the world. Never before had a president of the United States taken such a goodwill trip, and CBS News White House correspondent Robert Pierpoint went along.
President Eisenhower inaugurated this new era of personal diplomacy during the summer months when he paid a quick visit to three European capitals, Bonn, London, and Paris. The warm welcome that greeted the president in each nation was a pleasant portent of even warmer welcomes to come. His first stop was Bonn, and there President Eisenhower, who less than 15 years before had been the conquering general, was now received like an old friend by some 300,000 cheering, flower-throwing, approving Germans. In London, the crowds were larger than in the relatively small town of Bonn, and just as enthusiastic in their welcome to the traveling American president. Perhaps the personal high point of his trip to Great Britain was his overnight stay at Scotland's Balmoral Castle, where Queen Elizabeth and the royal family welcomed the president at the castle gate to the Queen's Guards bagpipes. Taking leave of the royal family, the president then returned to London, where he and Prime Minister Macmillan held a radio-television fireside chat, talked about their hopes for a summit meeting which might ease world tensions. Then the president headed for Paris to confer with France's proud, stubborn President Charles de Gaulle. President de Gaulle escorted President Eisenhower up the Champs-Élysées toward the Arch of Triumph in one of those spectacular parades of pomp and splendor that the French do so well. At a regular news conference held November 4th, President Eisenhower announced an 11-nation, 22,000-mile trip that would help him fulfill a long-time ambition, a journey to India. Along the way, the president would stop for brief visits with several nations that are important American friends and allies. But the real purpose of his trip was to get a personal look at the people and problems of the Asian subcontinent. Bad weather, rain, and bitter cold dampened the first stop in Rome. But by the time he called on Pope John the 23rd at the Vatican on Sunday morning, President Eisenhower's traditional luck with the weatherman had brought back the Mediterranean sunshine. From Rome, the presidential party flew on to Ankara, where Turkey's President Bayar and others who had gathered at the airport to welcome him heard a smiling American president try to talk Turkish.
I know that I speak for all the members of my party when I respond to your warm words of welcome by saying, somewhat haltingly, I fear, but nevertheless sincerely, Hoş bulduk, çok teşekkür ederim.
The Turks had gone all out to welcome President Eisenhower, had lined the road into the center of Ankara with huge decorated arches, American and Turkish flags, and hundreds of thousands of cheering Turks. There was also folk dancing in the streets, while colorfully costumed Janissary bands, court musicians from the days of the sultans, played out their welcomes along the parade route. The Turks, neighbors of the Russians and adamantly anti-communist, wanted assurance that America was not going to let Khrushchev sweet-talk the West into lowering its guard. The president gave that assurance. The next stop was Karachi, where President Eisenhower spent a day and a half with Pakistan's dynamic new leader, Army General and now President Ayub Khan.
My country has been looking forward to receive you joyously because, more than anybody else in this age, you symbolize in your person the principles of universal peace, freedom, and goodwill.
The two generals got along well together. President Eisenhower watched an exciting display of Pakistani horsemanship, inspected Ayub Khan's refugee slum clearance projects, at an evening banquet, watched fascinated while musicians and dancers gave a demonstration of the traditional dances of Pakistan. This was President Eisenhower's first stop on Asian soil, his first opportunity to see for himself the poverty and disease that grips Asia's teeming peoples, his first experience of the warmth of an Asian welcome, as half a million or more Pakistanis gathered to see and cheer the President of the United States. Before flying onward, President Eisenhower talked over with Pakistan's President Ayub Khan such problems as more economic and military aid and the settlement of the touchy Kashmir issue with India. On his way to India, the president made a brief stop in the ancient and backward kingdom of Afghanistan. As he stood next to King Mohammed Zahir during the playing of the Star Spangled Banner, President Eisenhower did not betray the strangeness he must have felt when six Russian-built MiG fighters zoomed overhead in salute. From the Russian-built airfield, the president rode over a Russian-paved highway into Kabul. But the welcoming crowds of ragged hill tribesmen and their almost equally ragged Kabul city cousins and the sounds of their welcome were all strictly Afghani. Slightly delayed, the president arrived in Delhi just before dusk. There he was met by India's Prime Minister Nehru, President Prasad, and a million Indians. The enthusiasm of their welcome stopped the motorcade several times, damaged the president's limousine, badly scared the Secret Service, and enormously pleased President Eisenhower. At the end of that first exciting day, the president was treated to an Indian dance and music recital at the Rashtrapati Bhavan, the presidential palace where he stayed in India. The president spent four full days in India, spoke to the parliament, opened a World Agricultural Fair, visited the famed Taj Mahal, inspected a mud hut Indian farm village, and was hailed as a hero by half a million Indians at a civic reception. On his way back from India, President Eisenhower stopped briefly in Iran, where his words of peace and friendship may have helped prop the Shah's shaky regime. In Greece, back again in the Western world, he received one of the most spontaneously enthusiastic welcomes of his entire trip. On the cruiser Des Moines, the president sailed from Athens across the Mediterranean for a brief call on Tunisia's president, Habib Bourguiba, then on to France and the Western Summit, and the next stop, Madrid, where President Eisenhower stayed overnight with dictator Franco. He rose early the next morning, breakfasted with Franco, then flew on to newly independent Morocco. At Casablanca, he agreed with King Mohammed V to evacuate American bases from Morocco by the end of 1963. Late that afternoon, the presidential jet took off from Casablanca for Washington and home. The trip had lasted an exhausting 19 days, but at its end, President Eisenhower looked remarkably fit.
The slight warming of the Cold War this year became noticeable around the middle of the year. Many well-informed observers believed it was the increased flexibility of our foreign policy which stimulated the friendlier relations between the Soviets and the West. This added flexibility became apparent when Christian Herter was named Secretary of State after cancer-claimed John Foster Dulles. That story now by Howard K. Smith.
For 7 years, the strong, sometimes inflexible personality of John Foster Dulles dominated America's foreign policy. But at 71, Dulles's health was failing. He had a second attack of cancer, and in April he was forced to step down. President Eisenhower appointing Christian Herter in his place. Observers wondered if Herter's appointment would mean a change in policy, but the new secretary denied this.
I think you can assume from the fact that I've been a member of a team for some time that the team policies will continue.
On May the 24th, while the foreign ministers were talking and getting nowhere in Geneva, John Foster Dulles died in Walter Reed Hospital in Washington. And it seemed almost ironic that his funeral was held on May the 27th, the deadline set by Khrushchev for the West to get out of Berlin. Washington's entire diplomatic corps attended the funeral at Arlington National Cemetery, including the big four foreign ministers who flew in from Geneva to pay respects to the man who dominated Western policy for so long. With the passing of Dulles, President Eisenhower appeared to take a more personal hand in this country's foreign affairs. And just 2 months later, he announced the event that Dulles had always prevented, a Khrushchev visit to the United States.
Some time back, I suggested to the State Department that I believed in the effort to melt a little bit of the ice that seems to freeze our relationships between with the Soviets, that possibly A visit such as I now have proposed would be useful. And we studied this thing, and in early July, I initiated the correspondence that finally brought about an agreement.
If the end of the Dulles era did not mean any dramatic change in this country's foreign policies, it almost certainly did mean a change in the approach to those policies.
The increased warmth between East and West in 1959 led to an increase in cultural exchanges. We sent our best artists to Russia, and they sent their best here. Russian Deputy Premier Frau Koslov came here to open his country's impressive exhibition. And Vice President Nixon went to Moscow to open our dazzling display. Paul Niven went with the Vice President to report that story.
Within 24 hours of his arrival in Moscow, the Vice President was engaged in a fantastic marathon political debate with Nikita Khrushchev. It wasn't Nixon's doing. He was merely showing Khrushchev the highlights of the American exhibition, one of which was a television studio used for color videotape demonstrations. Seeing cameras and microphones, old ham Khrushchev swung into battle.
How many years has America existed already? 300? 150 years of independence. Well, then, we will say America has existed 150 years, and this is her level of achievement. We have existed not quite 42 years, and 7 years from now, we will be on the same level of achievements as America. In the following years, we shall continue to surge ahead. And when we shall overtake you at the crossroads, we shall wave at you.
I can only say that if this competition, which you have just described so effectively, in which you plan to outstrip us, and particularly in the production of consumer goods, if this competition is to do the best for both of our peoples and for people everywhere, there must be a free exchange of ideas. There are some instances where you may be ahead of us. For example, in the development of the thrust of your rockets for the investigation of outer space. There may be some instances, for example, color television, where we're ahead of you. But in order for both of us to benefit,
You see, you never concede anything.
In what are they ahead of us? Wrong, wrong. We are ahead of you in rockets as well as in this technique. I do not capitulate.
Let's have a far more communication and exchange in this very area that we speak of. We should hear you more on our television. You should hear us more on yours.
Nixon was seen more on Soviet television, heard more on Soviet radio, printed more in Soviet newspapers, met face-to-face by more Soviet citizens than any American had been since the Iron Curtain descended at the end of the last war. His message was that the American people do not want another war, that they want only to keep on enjoying in peace and freedom the highest living standard in the history of the world. It was a simple message, but the 200 million people of the Soviet Union had never been permitted to hear it before.
This was a year of scandal and big money television quiz shows. A parade of witnesses came before a congressional committee to tell how they were given the answers to the questions in advance. The public was shocked. The industry was shaken. Big money winners, who had been considered mental giants, toppled from public favor. The biggest of these was Charles Van Doren, the winner of $129,000, who became a $50,000-a-year television personality because of his fame. Van Doren at first denied the accusation that he was helped with the answers. But when he finally appeared before the committee, he bared his soul. Afterward, he told reporters that the truth was the best way after all.
I feel better than I have in a long, long time, and I recommend this feeling to anybody. Anybody who's ever gets, I hope nobody ever gets in this situation. I really hope that they never do. But there's only one way to live with it if you do, and that is to tell the truth.
This was also a year which saw strange behavior by the governor of Louisiana, Earl K. Long. The governor's eccentricities had been accepted as part of the fabric of his family. He was the brother of the late Kingfish of Louisiana, Huey Long. But when old Earl's wife had him committed to a mental institution in nearby Texas, the fireworks began to explode. Long managed to get out. He fired everyone he thought was against him, and he called a special session of the legislature. In an interview in the governor's mansion in Baton Rouge, he offered this background for some of the unusual goings-on in Louisiana.
I'm not quite as dead or as crazy as some of them thought I was. And the only way I got out was kind of play mouse in, possumy, and kind of slip around till I could finally get me a good lawyer, you know, Mr. Cangelosi, I thought was representing me. I'd been good to him. I helped him make hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I found out he's representing everybody but me. Yes, he's been slipping around, Ms. Long. Used to every time I come to the mansion, that long-legged sucker's over here drinking coffee, coming back to dinner. He's here in the morning, he's here in the evening. I never did suspect anything. I didn't know what they were up to. Well, there's in all kind of businesses. All kinds.
1959 was also a year of great discovery and progress in the area of space exploration. The Russians were clearly ahead of us. They announced several startling successes. We made progress, too, but we also had our failures. That story by George Herman.
To those Earth dwellers who gazed out at the moon and the stars this past year and wondered when man would reach them and what we'd learn in the process, 1959 has been a year of announcements from Moscow. On January 2nd, Radio Moscow told the world of the first cosmic rocket, which we now call Lunik 1.
The USSR has today launched a rocket towards the moon. It has entered its trajectory according to program, and first reports indicate that the last step has received the required second cosmic speed. About 7 a.m. Moscow time on January 4th, the rocket will reach the vicinity of the moon.
In September, Moscow announced the launching of a rocket aimed at the moon and predicted where it would hit. And on September 13th, it announced that the rocket had, in fact, hit the moon in the selected area, delivering metallic Soviet flags to the moon. And Premier Khrushchev, arriving in Washington 2 days later, pointedly greeted President Eisenhower with these words.
Shortly before this meeting with you, Mr. President, the Soviet scientists, engineers, technicians, and workers filled our hearts with joy by launching a rocket to the moon. We have no doubt that the excellent scientists, engineers, and workers of the United States of America who are engaged in the field of conquering the cosmos will also carry their pennant over to the moon. The Soviet pennant, as an old resident, will then welcome your pennant, and they will live there together in peace and friendship, as we should live together on Earth in peace and friendship, and as all people should live who inhabit our common Mother Earth, who is so generous to us all with her gifts.
American scientists explained to the world rather lamely that hitting the moon was easier than circling around it, as we hope to do. But our own moon rocket blew up on the stand during a test on October 4th. Moscow announced the rocket, which was to circle the moon and take the only pictures now in existence of its hidden side.
Today, a new and wonderful announcement was made. The launching of the third Soviet space rocket will, without doubt, enrich science with new and unique information about the universe, thus preparing man's flight to the stars. The Soviet people are at a rapid pace reaching interplanetary space.
The day after this boast, this correspondent interviewed Dr. Herbert York, the Defense Department's Director of Research, and asked him how the United States might put on a burst of speed and catch up to the Russian drive into space. Dr. York's answer was characteristically blunt.
There's no way to hurry up. There's no way to overcome the basic advantage they have of having a rocket, their big rocket, be twice as big as ours in less than several years. During these several years, we will be putting ever bigger payloads into space by using better upper stages on top of our ICBMs. But the Russians can do the same, and thereby I expect their program will result in ever-increasing payload sizes, too, with theirs being roughly twice as big as ours for several years. And there's nothing we can do about that during these several years.
Our own space effort was characteristically diversified, ingenious, and scientifically profitable. Two Vanguard satellites went into orbit. So did 6 out of 8 Discoverers circling the Earth from pole to pole. Explorer 6, the paddle wheel satellite, and Explorer 7 went into orbit. Pioneer 7 passed the moon, unfortunately at too great a distance, and went into orbit around the sun. And monkeys Abel and Baker made their famous ride in the nose cone of a ballistic missile. But all these ingenious experiments only emphasize the mastery of the Russians over a huge and powerful rocket suitable for space work. Dr. Werner von Braun, the man who first put America into space, urged faster development of our own huge Saturn rocket, the million-pound thrust rocket which we hope will put us neck and neck with Russia. Dr. von Braun warned of Russian abilities.
I would caution that we have not seen the last of the Soviet space rockets either. The momentum they have built up in their program, the mass of experimental data they have acquired, will make possible other startling feats in the not-too-distant future. We have been told that the hammer and sickle flag has now been planted on the moon, and we have no reason to doubt it. I would not be at all surprised to be hearing a human voice from outer space that will have an unmistakable Russian accent.
But now, in the month of the new federal budget, it becomes apparent that while the Russians are racing with us, we are not racing with anyone. Saturn has been switched to the Civilian Space Agency, along with Dr. von Braun and his rocket team. But Saturn will not get the funds needed for major acceleration. Army General Medaris, retiring from his former job as von Braun's boss, urges an end to indecision and a little plain old-fashioned get up and go.
Now, the question is, can we catch up? The only way, obviously, that we can catch up is to go faster than they go from here on, and I don't know how fast that is. So maybe we just better run like hell.
But as 1960 gets underway, the American slogan in space seems to be, walk, do not run. And President Eisenhower has set the mood with his slogan of, be not the first to try the new.
1959 began for this country with about 5 million workers listed as unemployed. But the situation was improving so much, in fact, that in April, Labor Secretary James Mitchell rose before an unemployment rally sponsored by the AFL-CIO to make a prediction.
By October of this year, there will be 67 million people at work and that unemployment will be 3 million or less. And if I may say to my friend George Meany, if this isn't so, George, I'll eat that hat you said I was talking through.
When October came, the figures proved Mitchell wrong. There were more than 3 million people out of jobs, and Mitchell kept his word. He ate a confectionery hat on the steps of the Labor Department building. But the secretary blamed the steel strike for his miscalculation. That story now by CBS News correspondent Blair Clark.
This was the greatest strike in our history and what is still the most basic industry in the nation. It was twice as long as 1952's 55-day strike and at least twice as bitter. The bargaining on an industry-wide basis began on the 5th of May, and the session soon became just forums for attacks by each side on the other. The Steelworkers Union demanded higher wages, although they are among the highest paid industrial workers in the country. The industry, taking its cue from President Eisenhower's constant attacks on inflation, decided to stand firm. And the steel industry in 1959 saw a chance to make a gain of its own by breaking through the massive body of established work rules in the steel mills, rewriting them to increase efficiency. The United Steel Industry girded itself for the strike, and during the first half of the year, piled up great stocks of the basic metal to carry steel users through the anticipated strike period. Negotiations broke down, as expected, and on July 15th, the long walkout began. The strike dragged on, and although from time to time both sides met to talk, there was no progress toward a settlement. The president, reluctant to step in, finally had to take action when even the carefully prepared stockpiles began to dwindle dangerously. He appointed a fact-finding committee headed by Dr. George W. Taylor, who in mid-October finally reported to the president that both sides were so far apart that it was difficult even to define the issues.
This is no longer just a private dispute between two parties arguing about the conditions of employment. Involved are far greater issues involving the strength of this democracy. And I do hope that the parties will realize the broader issues that are involved in the dispute.
The next day, industry's chief negotiator, R. Conrad Cooper, offered what he thought would be a formula for settling the basic quarrel over work rules. He was willing to turn the whole problem over to arbitration.
I suggest to the members of the board that if the union will not agree with us on this basis, we see no possibility of settling this situation in collective bargaining in the foreseeable future.
The reaction to the arbitration offer by Union President David MacDonald was swift and contemptuous.
That arbitration proposal, that Cooperism, that heads I win, tails you lose offer, why, of course we reject it.
Since there was no hope, apparently, of settling the strike, either through negotiation or through the good offices of the presidential fact finders, President Eisenhower felt he had no choice but to ask for an 80-day injunction as provided by the Taft-Hartley law. The union fought the injunction all the way up to the Supreme Court, which on November 7th upheld the injunction and ordered 500,000 striking steelworkers back on the job. Union President MacDonald took this bitter view of the Supreme Court's decision.
We regret that the Supreme Court ruled in this manner and fashion, but now the companies have their heartfelt desire. They have an injunction forcing free steelworkers back into the mills against their will. This is truly operation of a slave labor act.
From the industry side, there was a different reaction, as voiced by Cooper.
A court order, of course, is not the basis on which we had hoped work might be resumed. We sought resumption on the basis of a sound new labor agreement. Throughout the negotiations, we have tried to reach a voluntary, non-inflationary agreement, which would be in the best interests of everyone. We will continue to strive for such a settlement.
In the nation's steel towns, which had been booming in 1959 after hard times in 1958, the workers seemed solidly back of their union leaders. And even as they went back to work for the 80 days ordered by the courts, they looked ahead to the strike's resumption, as did this worker.
I'm in a bad fix, like the rest of them, but I think if I have to eat beans and potatoes, I still would go back on the strike to get what we want.
It seemed, as the year ended, that prospects for the voluntary agreement the president hoped for were exceedingly dim. The 80-day period of work resumption was to end on January 26th, and a restive election year Congress would be back in session, ready to make new laws to force industry and labor to agree to work together.
This is the sound of reed pipes played by Tibetan lamas in the remote village of Siliguri, India. They are giving thanks for the escape of their living god, the Dalai Lama, who secretly made his way over some of the world's roughest terrain as the communist Chinese conquerors of Tibet followed in hot pursuit. The Dalai Lama was given asylum by India, and through one of his followers, he issued a message of hope and thanksgiving.
The Dalai Lama is extremely grateful to the people and government of India for their spontaneous and generous welcome, as well as the asylum granted to him and his followers. His country and people have passed through an extremely difficult period, and all that the Dalai Lama wishes to say at the moment is to express his sincere regret at the tragedy which has overtaken Tibet, and to fervently hope that these troubles would be over soon without any more bloodshed.
Here in America's own backyard, the year began with the sudden collapse on New Year's Day of the long despotic regime of Cuban dictator Fulgencio Batista. The bearded rebel Fidel Castro led his troops down from the mountains into Havana, and what followed was an orgy of public trials and executions combined with sweeping and radical reforms. That story by Stuart Novins.
This was the sound of Cuban victory on New Year's Day, 1959. The dictator Batista had been expelled, the rebellion was victorious, the revolution was about to begin. Now, 12 months later, the revolution is still going on. It has been a hasty revolution, seldom planned, often improvised, frequently harsh, never insignificant. It was a popular rebellion led by bearded Fidel Castro. And it is Castro who now leads the social and political and economic revolution. On January 1st of 59, Castro, who had promised the right things as a rebel leader, was faced with the job of delivering on those promises. But while Castro talked about eventual civilian justice, his military tribunals went into action. In the first week, several hundred persons were tried, convicted, and executed. At the first public trial in the Havana Sports Palace, defendant Major Sosa Blanco, translated here as he speaks in his own defense, describes the atmosphere of the trials.
I am in the Colosseum of Rome. I have nothing to speak of. If I am judged by Jesus Christ, I have nothing to speak about. I am only a military man who complied with his orders. And if you have killed, like I have killed, in act of war, then you are criminals also.
The public trials helped to let off some of the steam that had built up during the years of Batista atrocities. But they could not eliminate the basic Cuban problem, poverty. The responsibility for government action rested with the cabinet of President Urrutia. But the only man with power was Castro. When the prime minister didn't move fast enough, radically enough, Castro became prime minister himself. When President Urrutia publicly criticized communist influences in Cuban policymaking, he was publicly fired by Castro. And when army supporters resigned in protest to the breaking of promises made in the mountains, they were condemned as counter-revolutionaries. The criticism which followed his first flush of victory stung Castro.
We are not afraid to be submitted to the public opinion judge, because we are fulfilling our duty as patriot, as human, and as democratic men. And I want that the newsmen come to Cuba. That is the best way of proving that the United States does not know the truth. The best way to prove the truth is seeing. I invite all the newsmen of the United States to come here.
By mid-year, Castro's supporters among the rich had been isolated by his policies of expropriation. His supporters among the middle class had been disenchanted by the effects of his economic decrees. Castro shifted the base of his power to the landless peasant and the jobless laborer.
Si con algún país los Estados Unidos debieron ser cuidadosos, si con algún país
In Marathon television speeches, Castro laid the blame for Cuba's troubles at the doorstep of what he called American imperialists. He accused Americans of bombing Havana, of economic strangulation, of intervention in Cuba's affairs. And the larger number of Cubans, the exploited under every Cuban administration, listened and shouted for firing squads. The unrest in Cuba, the anti-Americanism, the political and economic uncertainties played into the hands of the communists, those inside Cuba and those imported. It is these influences which, as 1959 drew to a close, led Secretary of State Christian Herter to say that the United States is unhappy with the deterioration of relations between our government and the island republic 90 miles off our shores.
We have tried to discuss with the Cuban government a number of the problems that have caused that deterioration and have found that the present Cuban government is not anxious to talk with us.
At year's end, Castro still faced gigantic internal problems at home, complicated by the threat of counter-revolution. He remained fixed in his determination to bring the revolution to Cuba, or, as he has said, to go down with it.
In the spring of this year, a foreign ministers' conference was assembled in neutral Geneva. A Khrushchev-imposed crisis over Berlin hung heavy in the air, but the Western Big Three would not be frightened out and leave 2 million free Germans to their inevitable fate. But they were willing to talk with the Russians, and Soviet Foreign Minister Gromyko said publicly that he, too, was willing to negotiate.
Our intentions are serious, and as far as the Soviet side is concerned, we shall make every effort for this conference to be crowned with success.
Although Gromyko said he was serious, the talks got nowhere, and another international conference ended as just a lot of talk and propaganda. All this was part of the drive toward a summit conference. But before a summit conference could be arranged, the West wanted to get its own differences reconciled. And a Western summit was convened in Paris in mid-December. David Schonbrunn covered that story.
The Western alliance, created 10 years ago when the Russians were brandishing their fists, is having some trouble remaining united now that the Russians are waving olive branches. And NATO Secretary General Paul-Henri Spaak publicly admitted his concern about Allied differences in a news conference here in Paris.
I do not think we should exaggerate. It is perfectly true that as regards certain questions, military as well as political, different views are held by different members of the alliance.
If NATO officials frankly admitted their concern, so did the Western chiefs of government when they arrived here for their summit conference. President Eisenhower, the first of the summit climbers to arrive here on the morning of Friday, December the 18th, while reasserting his faith in the common cause, also admitted that there were divisions between France and America. The president is speaking on the dock in the naval arsenal of Toulon, his port of arrival.
In the vicissitudes and circumstances of international life, not always has everything been clear sailing, but the underlying affection, respect of the two nations, each for the other, has never lessened.
A few hours after Eisenhower's arrival, the trumpets sound ceremonially for the German Chancellor and the British Prime Minister.
Mr.
danke Ihnen sehr, Herr Ministerpräsident, für den herzlichen Willkommengruß, den Sie mir eben ausgesprochen haben.
The German Chancellor, too, was frank in his public statement. He's saying that the welfare and peace of Europe are at stake in these Western meetings. Adenauer fears that his country and his people will be the ones to pay the price for peace, that Berlin may be sacrificed on the altar of coexistence. Britain's Prime Minister is sensitive to French pride, so in an elegant gesture, the Englishman spoke French in delivering his airport statement.
Monsieur le Premier Ministre, je vous remercie de tout mon cœur les mots amicaux et chaleureux que vous avez dit.
Of all the big four Westerners, Harold Macmillan is the one who's pushed hardest for negotiations with the Russians. He started his campaign in February when he flew to Moscow, and the meeting here in Paris in December to prepare the basis of an East-West summit next year is a triumph for British diplomacy. Macmillan says that prospects for a successful meeting with the Russians next year are favorable. The summit meeting of the West lasted only 2 days, but some major decisions were made. The differences on military principles between de Gaulle on the one hand, Eisenhower and NATO allies on the other have not been resolved, but they did agree to make a fresh start towards solving them before meeting with the Russians. And so 1959 ended on an upbeat note. Whether this will prove to be durable or turn into discord again when West meets East is the big question for 1960.
As the year ended, a new decade of challenge follows a decade of change. The last 10 years began with the crisis of the Korean War. We saw the development of the hydrogen bomb and intercontinental missiles matched by an equally thunderous Soviet explosion and rocket proficiency. We lived through the turmoil of the McCarthy era and the tensions of school integration. We had hoped that Stalinism and its terrors were buried with the Russian dictator, but the ruthless way the Russians crushed the revolt in Hungary proved the intolerance of communist leadership. And we entered the space age. In the coming decade, we face the challenge of emerging nationalism among the underdeveloped countries. An exploding world population will complicate the problems. An East-West battle will be waged increasingly with economic weapons. 1960 and the years to follow surely will be years of challenge and promise.
You have been listening to the big news of 59. The top stories of the year, reported by the CBS News correspondents who covered these events. Your narrator was Walter Cronkite. This program was edited and produced for CBS News by Dan Bloom. Paul Thomas's address is the Star's address, the CBS Radio Network.